This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. You, me, the top experts, and 28 minutes to understand the world. That's The Briefing Room. This week, the great obesity strategy. Will it work? A brush with death can change a chap's mind.
I've always wanted to lose weight for ages and ages, and like I think many people, I struggle with my weight, go up and down. But when I went into ICU, when I was really ill, I was way overweight. You know, I was too fat.
If not exactly the road, Boris Johnson perhaps travelled the hospital corridor to Damascus. The result has been a new interventionist government obesity strategy. So what's in it? What's not? And what more needs to be done to deal with the country's obesity crisis? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Before you formulate the best way to tackle a problem, it's a good idea to understand what that problem actually is. David Buck used to work for the Department of Health, where he focused on inequalities. Now he's at the health policy think tank, the King's Fund.
In adults, overweight and obesity are measured by BMI, which is body mass index. It's essentially a number, and all it does, it divides an adult's weight in kilograms by their height in meters squared, and that leads you to a number. Every individual's got a number. 25 or 30 is considered overweight. Under 25 is considered a healthy weight. Obviously, very low numbers are poor too, because you're underweight. A number above 30 is considered obese, and a number above 35 considered very obese. The BMI is very, very useful at population level because it can tell you roughly what proportion of your population is at greater risk of various conditions and diseases. And we know that the BMI rises, we get more likely to have serious conditions and diseases, and the severity of it also increases. For the individual, it may not be quite as useful. So we all know people are very, very muscular, very, very fit. That means they're heavy. Muscle actually weighs a lot more than fat. So for the individual, you can be a really, really fit, healthy individual and have a very high BMI.
What's the scale of the problem here in the UK and how do we compare to other countries?
Around 30% of adults are obese and about 60%, two-thirds of adults are overweight or obese. So the majority of us are overweight or obese in the adult population. So it's being normalised. In children, around 1 in 5 children at reception, so that's about 4 to 5 years old, are overweight or obese. And by the time they get to about 10 or 11, it's about 1 in 3. Many of these statistics are talking about England, but the figures are broadly the same for the rest of the UK. Compared to other countries, the country that really tips the scale on this is the United States. About 30% of us adults are obese. In America, it's about 40%. Germany and France have lower levels of obesity. Japan and Korea have very, very low levels of obesity. But some countries, and particularly those in South America, some emerging economies actually have higher levels of obesity than us. So Mexico, Chile, New Zealand, higher levels. So we're not doing well, but we're not as bad as the United States.
One of the claims that's being made most recently is its identification of obesity with coronavirus. And in fact, the government campaign links obesity specifically to coronavirus. Now, what do we know about that link?
It doubles your risk of severe coronavirus. It doesn't necessarily increase your risk of getting coronavirus, but if you do get it, being obese is going to be worse for you. And also, the more obese you are, and particularly severely obese, the risk rockets up in terms of poor outcomes. Now, that may be related to some degree to the fact that we also know that coronavirus is linked to diabetes. But we do think there's also an independent association with obesity. So if you're obese and you don't happen to have diabetes, you are still at greater risk of a poor coronavirus outcome. Now, why that is the case is still being looked at.
What do we understand to be the causes of obesity?
On one level, that's a very simple question. It's essentially the relation between calories in and calories out. If we consume more energy than we use up, we tend to put on weight. Why has that happened at this point in time? What's happened around us is actually our societies have changed. So it's much easier and cheaper to eat calorie-dense food. And also, to some extent, our lifestyles have changed. We're slowing down and we're eating more, and it's easier for us to eat more calorie-dense foodstuffs.
Has that change happened equally for different strata in society?
It's something that affects us all, but it doesn't affect us all equally. So there's a big link with deprivation levels. If you're in the most deprived parts of the country or most deprived conditions, you're about twice as likely to be obese or overweight. There's also a specific link with some ethnicities, in particular for males. For people from a Black or African descent, there's a higher chance of being obese as an adult. Now, some of that may be cultural, some of that may be physiological, some of that may be socioeconomic as well.
Although we have a significant problem here in the United Kingdom, actually, more recently, the level of overweightness has been levelling off.
That's true. We do think that overweight has been levelling off, although obesity is still rising, and particularly for males. But overall, we're starting to see a plateau.
Does that mean that some of the things that we have been doing so far have worked, or is it down to something else?
It's likely that some of those things will have been working, but they certainly have not been working as well as they could do, given the fact that 60% of us as adults are overweight or obese. And successive governments have attempted to introduce policies with targets saying we're going to reduce the proportion of the population that's overweight. So what we haven't seen is enough success on those against the government's own stated targets and policies.
David Buck. That's the shape, size and weight of the problem. Next into the briefing room is doctor turned BBC health reporter Smita Mundasad, who can tell us what's in the new strategy. Smita, most of the headlines about the obesity strategy have been about junk food. Could you just take me through what is meant by junk food? Is there actually a definition?
Most of what we have heard is around the advertising ban before 9 p.m. on TV and online. Now, there's actually already a ban in place around children's programming specifically. And with that ban, junk food is defined as food that is high in salt, sugar, and fat. And the way that companies know whether they can put adverts for their products on TV around children's programming at the moment is something called nutrient profiling. Now, you see how much sugar there is, how much fat there is, how much salt there is. And you balance that against any helpful nutrients like protein or perhaps fibre. And at the end of that, you get given a score. And depending on the threshold is whether you can advertise it or not. The thoughts are that it's going to be very similar around this new advertising ban, but the details are still a little sketchy.
Well, that would make sense, wouldn't it, if you already got a definition to extend it. What else is changing?
In England, we're seeing the end of buy one, get one free deals when it comes to food that's high in fat, sugar and salt, so really junk food as we mostly know it. And there's also going to be a ban on where they can be placed in supermarkets and shops. So the idea is we won't be able to see them at the end of aisles by the checkout, for example, where we'd be more tempted to buy these kind of products. And Scotland has also been considering making similar changes, and I imagine Wales won't want to get left behind.
What about calorie labelling?
The government says there's going to be new laws that will require large restaurants, cafes and takeaways that have more than 250 members of staff to add calorie labels to their food. They're also going to encourage smaller businesses to provide this kind of information in a voluntary way.
What about help for people who want to lose weight?
The government says it's going to expand NHS weight loss services so that people get more support to lose weight. Also online tools, including that it's a sort of a 12-week weight loss plan. I downloaded this and it gets you to put in, as you'd expect, your weight, your age. Then it tells you if you're under or overweight. And then with all that information, it makes a personalised plan for you where you have to, over the 12 weeks, record how many calories you are eating a day. It gives you some advice on how many you should be eating a day and then suggests that you weigh yourself every week. And the idea is that at the end of those 12 weeks, you will have seen significant positive changes.
What about the health service itself? Are GPs, for example, going to have a bigger role in trying to sell this strategy?
Many of us will have heard the headlines that GPs will be encouraged to prescribe things like cycling, for example. But there's also a suggestion from government that GPs would get incentivised financially to help people lose weight, so that if a GP sees someone who is overweight or obese, they may have to ask certain questions and signpost them to weight loss services. And by doing so, they would get some money for their practice.
Okay, so those are the things that are in the strategy. What hasn't made it into the strategy? There doesn't seem to be a sugar tax, does there? And there doesn't seem to be anything about a medical approach to obesity.
In 2018, the government put in a mandatory sugar tax on sugary drinks. And there are suggestions that this has been a real success story, that it has meant that companies have reformulated their drinks so that they're not having to pay the sugar tax. And so some people were hoping to see in this strategy that that type of tax would be expanded to look at things like sugary foods, maybe sweets and confectionery. And some have been disappointed that that hasn't been included, particularly if it is such a success. Others are concerned that there hasn't been much on the reformulation of products so that there are fewer unhealthy parts to that particular product. And some have called for a ban on energy drinks for children, and this has been consulted on. So there is some upset that this hasn't been looked at in this strategy too.
Now, this is a strategy. Some of it will go out to consultation, presumably. Do we know which bits of it will be done and which bits of it, therefore, are just for discussion?
It seems that the laws on advertising will come in. There seems to be a very firm commitment there, and the buy one, get one free promotions ending for junk food. But I wouldn't expect to see them anytime soon. I think there'll still be a couple of years with some consultation around exactly how to do it.
Smita Mundasad. We've tried to define the problem and its causes, and we know what's in the new strategy. Now I want to know whether the cure as laid out matches the disease. To try to evaluate the strategy's chances for success, I'm joined by Susan Jebb, Professor of Diet and Population Health at the University of Oxford and a member of the Public Health England Obesity Programme. She was involved in putting together the strategy and was an advisor to the National Food Strategy, also published this week. And Professor Corinna Hawkes, Director of the Centre for Food Policy at City University and Vice-Chair of the London Child Obesity Task Force.
I think it's the most significant policy announcement we've seen on obesity probably in my whole career. We know that many, many people are continually trying to lose weight on their own. And we also know, we've got very good evidence, that actually if people are part of formal weight loss programmes, they do very much better. And so what I think this strategy is about is saying, how can we provide access to weight management programmes at scale to people who will benefit the most? And that's why the link in through GPs is very, very important. GPs are ideally placed to understand who could get the most benefit from these kinds of services.
We'll come on to some aspects of that as well later, but the one question that arises for me is whether GPs have the time to do that.
What's being proposed is referring people to other services. And that's really the same approach that we have for smoking cessation. So doctors raise the issue and refer people to stop smoking services. It takes very little time. It's what we call a brief intervention. You know, let's face it, if we're successful with this strategy, in fact, we'll reduce the demands on GPs because we'll have fewer people with diabetes, heart disease, and so on. Now, I accept that that's in the future, but nonetheless, it's part of this whole move to put much more emphasis on prevention.
Now, Corinna Hawkes, you could argue that dealing with advertising and clever positioning in shops, which entices people to eat things that are, and consume things that are not very good for them, are actually some of the easiest things that you could possibly do. What are the other drivers, essentially, that you're trying to deal with as to why people consume too much?
There's food environments, what the government is trying to do with the promotional environment in stores. There's also health systems. Susan's just referred to those. If they're not playing a role, there's a lack of understanding among the public that this is actually important, given that people do trust health professionals. A third system, though, is the economic system. So if people experience financial insecurity, they are much more likely to make choices which are driven by financial concerns than they are about health concerns. Then there's the psychological aspects of people's lives, their self-esteem, mental health. Do they get social support? Your relationship with your children, are they pestering you? Do you feel guilty? You want to make them happy, so you give them snack foods. You want them to be healthy, but you feel guilty that you're not able to give them other things, but you can afford to give them snack foods. So the psychological, the social, the cultural, the economic, as well as the food and the health system, they all come into play as drivers. And that's what makes it so complex. And that's why we need to take quite a people-centred approach to understanding what are these different drivers that people experience on the ground in order to know how to really tackle it effectively.
Well, that is indeed a complex sequence. And I've got to ask you, does this strategy encompass that complexity?
Not entirely, no. It takes on some pieces of it. I welcome those pieces. This is not a situation where we say it's complex, we've got all of these things to do, and it's only worth doing if we do all of it. No, that's just a recipe for inaction.
There is so much to be done, it can be really hard to know where to start. And so I think what this does is to pick off some very, very specific areas. But what we also need is for this kind of thinking to be embedded in other policies too. And so what the National Food Strategy is proposing is that we should put much greater investment into school meals, better free access to school meals for families receiving universal credit, better provision of healthy food in the holidays. And those things are going to be really important as part of this bigger prevention piece, so that we give children, particularly those living in the most deprived families, opportunities to access healthy, nutritious food.
Corinna Hawkes, I'm slightly scarred by the memory of when Jamie Oliver launched his Good Food in Schools campaign, of the parents standing outside the school gates feeding chips in through to their children inside. And part of what you've both been talking about feels a little bit like essentially feeding people's children for them with good food because they won't.
People care about the health of their children, and often what their number one concern is are they eating enough? And if they're not eating enough, I am failing as a parent, often a mother, and they are not healthy. So we need to meet parents where they are and actually understand that they care deeply. Most parents care deeply about the health of their children, but it actually often plays out with them feeding them unhealthy food. And actually, they seem to be contradictory, but they're not. And that goes back to the point that unless very young children, infants, in fact, babies, are not surrounded by healthy food at the very start of life, and that is also delicious, their taste preferences will always be oriented towards high fat, high sugar and salty foods. So then parents struggle with their kids because they say their kids are, inverted commas, fussy. Therefore, they have to feed them unhealthy food, otherwise they won't eat enough.
If you wanted to use the analogy to cigarettes, what you might say is here are certain forms of foods which are made and advertise in a particular way, ban them or just make them incredibly difficult for people to come across. The difficulty, obviously, with that is that actually they can partially be valuable in giving people sources of calories, and you also interfere with people's freedom of choice. Now, how do we find that balance? A lot of people have said, for example, that in 40 years' time, we'll look upon some of these foods as we did look upon cigarettes and wonder why we tolerated them even being produced.
Yes, I think we probably will. And yes, it is very difficult to ban them. And there is a question around the effectiveness of doing that. So we need to make sure that information is provided in products. We need to make sure that they're not misleading in any way. And we need to also reduce the promotion of those products. And that will be one mechanism by which we reduce demand. And once people stop demanding these products, they won't be produced anymore. What we have at the moment is a lot of malaligned incentives in the system. We need to disrupt that system in quite fundamental ways if we're going to make changes over the long term.
Susan Chebb, I imagine you agree with most of that, but you may be sensitive also to the argument that's been launched on so many fronts, that many people in the country are fed up with being told how to live their lives and what they should say and what they shouldn't say. And this kind of represents something of a backlash against how the establishment talks. How conscious are you of that in this field?
Oh, absolutely conscious. I mean, what has in a way blighted and held up obesity policies for so many years is this sort of fear by ministers of being accused of being the nanny state. And that's really stopped a huge amount of action. I think what's happened here, and I think it's a very clever reframing of it, is to say, actually, we are not infringing anybody's choice at all. You are completely free to choose these products. We're not trying to ban anything. But what we are going to do is reduce the active encouragements to eat the wrong things. So that means ending the promotion of foods high in fat, sugar and salt, and encouraging manufacturers instead to promote the healthier parts of their range, banning the advertising of these products. That doesn't stop people eating chocolate, but it stops encouraging them to do the wrong thing. And also the introduction of things like calorie labelling means that people will know how many calories are in a yogurt or in a muffin or even in a fancy cup of coffee. You can still choose it, but you'll be able to make an informed choice. You know, the thing that's in our favour is most people want to eat healthily, but at the moment, it's really hard because all the nudges in the system nudge us to the wrong things. The wrong foods in large portions are sold relatively cheaply.
But as we've heard, one thing that wasn't in the obesity strategy was any expansion of the sugary drinks levy to say sugary snacks or even just more sugary drinks, despite the fact, I think, that we believe it works. So why is that?
Well, it has been very successful, but the sugary drink levy was a very specific policy and it was primarily designed to encourage companies to reformulate and reduce the amount of sugar in their drinks. That's relatively easy to do in drinks because you can replace sugar with non-nutritive sweeteners and they're mostly water, so that's fine. The challenges of reformulating foods are much, much greater. If you take sugar out of confectionery, you don't have a sweet, you know, left. You can't use the levy to provide that incentive to manufacturers in the same way. That said, I am absolutely in favour of a direct sales tax on confectionery because we know that putting up the price reduces purchasing.
It seems to me it's one thing to make the bad stuff less appealing. It's another to make the good stuff more appealing and more available. How do you do that?
Through a variety of means. One of them is about making the healthy foods delicious and more available and accessible to young children in order that they value those foods and learn to like them. And that really does bring in the role of nurseries of earlier settings and schools. It's also about what supermarkets and other stores can do. If they're going to remove the kind of promotional activity we know can tempt people away from the better choice, we need to replace them with the healthier alternatives.
thinking about the sort of wider population, this is a real opportunity for the food industry. They've done quite a bit, actually, in recent years. So making fruit and vegetables more convenient, lots of growth in kind of ready meals, but actually meals where you can assemble the ingredients yourself in quite a convenient way, but generally which include more fruit and vegetables. And so the big difference between action on food in comparison with action on tobacco is tobacco. We just want to get rid of these companies who are trying to encourage people to smoke. But actually, we want a vibrant, successful food industry. And so the real opportunity is for companies to shift their business model to really emphasising the healthier ends of their portfolio. And by putting these restrictions on the less healthy food in place, that gives a real opportunity for the companies who are trying to do the right thing to sort of rise to the top of the pile, rather than everybody scrabbling around to just sell as much cheap, high-calorie food as they possibly can.
There is a real opportunity, and one of the benefits of regulations is that it does level the playing field so that there can be a race to the top for healthier products. But we also need to encourage entrepreneurship and new business to come into this. And given that we're at a point in our history where there's a lot of financial stimulus in the system in order to aid the recovery from COVID-19, there is an actual opportunity here for a healthy food financing package. I would like to see new businesses supported to reduce a bit of their risk and to shelter them as they emerge, in order that smaller businesses, medium-sized businesses, are incentivized to actually start to produce and sell healthier foods.
One other aspect to any counter-obesity and healthy living strategy is exercise and living a less sedentary lifestyle. How convinced are you that the government is beginning to get a handle on that?
The challenge is that the most effective way of really doing this, according to the World Health Organization, is to build it into people's everyday lives. And yet we've constructed a world in the West which disincentivizes it. So it really is quite a tough challenge. It requires urban planning at the local level and to really change the culture of how we move. There's so much work to be done, and it needs to really start with having children being able to play out in the street and walk to school. And at the moment, that is really quite tricky. People are concerned about air pollution. They're concerned about safety. And so let's start somewhere.
Susan Jebb.
We have seen something quite remarkable recently, because not only have we had an obesity plan, which mostly focuses on food, but the following day we had the walking and cycling plan. I haven't studied it in detail, but I think that that does recognise that we have got to get more active travel back into our daily lives as one of the best chances we have to make people a little bit more active.
So essentially, we have to help people lead healthier lifestyles, both with food, and here's a significant start to that, but also with regard to their lifestyles, and we're beginning to look at that.
For people who are trying to lose weight, there is absolutely no doubt that you really need to focus on your diet in order to get the weight off. But there's very good evidence that becoming more physically active helps people to keep the weight off in the long term, and certainly adds to the health benefits. And when we're talking about primary prevention, helping people to avoid weight gain in the first place, then it's clear that people who are more physically active find it easier to manage their weight. So the two both go along together. And if we start, you know, tying one hand behind our back by saying it's one or the other, I don't think that's very helpful.
Susan Jebb and Corinna Hawkes. My thanks also to David Buck and Smita Mundasad. My conclusion? Well, we have evidence that government interventions can make some difference here. But for the longer term, we're involved in trying to change food cultures, lifestyles, and maybe even social inequalities. So my guess is that we'll be back here talking about this again. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It was produced by Ben Crichton, Kirsty Knight and Joe Kent. It was mixed by James Beard, and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you may find other episodes interesting, including one on the link between eating meat and climate change, on how local lockdowns work, and on how to tackle rising unemployment in the wake of the coronavirus. You can find them all and much, much more on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.